Environment and Natural Resources. And I think what we'll do, let's start with Senate Bill 79. And here we are.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members. You actually heard about this bill
79.
On the 26th again. It's the new language that you have in front of you is actually the dash 4 amendments, which is also in the back of the room. There are people in the room that can, Mark Long's available to explain the amendments if you would like. But basically the changes is that it expands the number of members appointed to the task force to 13 from 9, requires that the task force develop recommendations for a voluntary energy performance scoring system instead of creating a voluntary energy performance scoring system for the State Department of Energy to adopt by rule. Specifies that the director of DCBS may consider other nationally recognized energy conservation standards.
Okay.
And there is a fiscal and revenue, or there's a fiscal statement available for you, and then there was a no revenue impact statement issued.
Okay, I'm going to ask Mark Long from DCBS to come up, please, and David Bantoff from the governor's office, would you like to join him? Now, we have walked through the dash threes, is that correct? Am I get the right?
Or the dash twos.
So now we have in front of us the dash four. So if you could tell us, Mark, for the just time management here, the difference, since we spent quite a bit of time on the previous amendments, what's the difference between the two amendments, if you can highlight that for the committee, and then if you can go over the fiscal, your portion of the fiscal, I think that would be helpful.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And you know what? I'm not sure I actually opened up a work session on Senate Bill 79, did I? Okay, so opening up a work session on Senate Bill 79.
Great.
Just in case.
Okay. Again, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm Administrator of State Building Codes. I work for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. You should have before you the dash fours, as staff has talked about. Just real quickly, I want to remind the committee, with the passage of this bill, and this is a complete rewrite of the bill through the dash four amendments, we're updating our building codes. We are creating a greater emphasis on energy efficiency in the building codes process. We are positioning Oregon to meet some of the federal stimulus guidelines. We're going to have consistency and predictability on a voluntary set of standards that are based on new technology. And, of course, we have the task force on developing recommendations on an energy performance score for new and existing buildings. The difference between the dash 2 and the dash 4 simply is this. It's clarifying individual areas of stakeholder concerns. I'll go through those very quickly. We went from 9 members of the task force to 13 to accommodate folks who wanted to participate. We're clarifying that the task force work is not to create something but to develop recommendations, and we also added provisions so that existing systems in Oregon will be recognized as part of that recommendation process. A minor amendment in one of the areas to change from goal of reducing energy cost to goal of reducing energy consumption. That probably covers most of them in the task force side. One other set of recommendations on changes in Section 2. We change from, again, the creation of a program to recommendations about what a program would look like. On the building code side, there are changes between the dash 2s and dash 4s around page 6. Most of this is clarifying my authority versus some of the state code advisory boards that we have, making sure that when we adopt new codes and standards that the boards are involved and they have the ability to review these standards and make their recommendations, and clarifying that, again, this applies to new construction, reconstruction, alteration, repair, which is an issue that was brought up at the last hearing. And that's about it. Questions on the bill or the amendments?
Are there any questions?
No.
I don't have a question. I have a comment. First of all, I just once again want to thank the department, your department, correct, not an agency, for working very hard and staffing these work groups along with our committee staff, Beth. And I also want to thank once again all the stakeholders. I know many of them are in this room. We heard from them last time. And I know that these, my understanding is that these amendments reflect the comments and the, I guess, suggestions that we heard from on the dash twos. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair, and it's my understanding we've obviously distributed the amendments, and my understanding is we have reached consensus on these amendments with all the various stakeholders.
Okay, thank you. And did you want to add anything from the governor's office, since this was governor's bill to begin with?
Madam Chair, rewritten? Members of the committee, Dave Antoff, for the record. Just to note again, I think I said the last work session on this, that we're just very pleased that folks worked hard to come to consensus, and we think this is a significant step forward in terms of improving energy efficiency in the built environment and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So we're just really thankful for all the work people put into it.
Okay. And then, as you will note, there is a fiscal on this, so this is being referred down to the Ways and Means Committee. I don't know if you want to make any comments on your part of the fiscal at all.
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. What my organization has done, part of the bill asks us to create REACH codes, which are these new voluntary codes to make available to developers, contractors, designers, that would be the latest and greatest new technology. The idea is to create greater predictability and consistency statewide. We have to do that in six or seven different code areas. We're asking for two limited duration positions, limited duration because we do not know what the ongoing workload is going to be, and we've worked out an intergovernmental arrangement for the funding of that to occur through my office and Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Energy.
Thank you for that clarification. I will accept a motion on this.
And it is part of the governor's budget, which I should mention.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments dated April 1, 2009 into Senate Bill 79.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated April 1, 2009. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection? Okay, Senator Boquist, so noted. With that, the motion carries and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 79 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Brzezinski moves Senate Bill 79 as amended with the Dash 4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be a no vote at this time until we see what the fiscal washes out downstairs in Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you. So there is a motion on the floor. Why don't we have the clerk call the roll for this one?
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Hatt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Excused.
Geraldine
Fielder? Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 79. And we will move on to the work session for Senate Bill 102. Beth, if you can give us a reminder, and we have a special guest here, I think, that would like to speak on this bill.
Senator Dean Felder and committee members, that Dash Senate Bill 102 extends air quality provisions relating to emissions from wood stoves to solid fuel burning devices. You have a Dash 2 amendment in front of you and also in the back of the room. And Andy Ginsberg is here from DEQ, so I'll probably let him go into the details of the bill. But a fiscal statement is issued and there's no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. And I think since Senator Walker's here and I know her time is of the essence, thank you for coming here. And this was your bill last session, I know, and it's been modified, but certainly would love to have your input on this.
Well, thank you, Senator Dingfelder. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I appreciate being here, and I also appreciate being here to see the passage of one of the first climate bills to come out of a committee and on their way to my committee in Ways and Means. And I was just visiting with the co-chairs in our weekly meeting, and we only had four policy bills, and they said, well, we expect more to be on their way, and so you've just added to that, and we have five. I am so excited to be here on 102 because last session, Andy and I and a number of people worked so hard on Senate Bill 338. Here's my bill file, and don't throw many things away. And we worked hard on it. It got to Ways and Means, and we pressured the co-chair, and he wouldn't let it go. So this session, I was prepared to bring it back and send out the governor had authorized it for DEQ to bring it forward. And as usual, Andy has done a tremendous job of getting this forward, and I'm so excited. And the reason I'm excited about it is because one of the communities that is on the non-attainment list for EPA is in my county. Senator Przanski knows very well. Oak Ridge has a real problem.
My district.
And that's in your district. It's in my county, our county. We always fight about what's in our district.
We share
much. We fight about the U of O students all the time. Most of them live in my district, but the university's in his district.
Hey, now.
I know. So, as you know, Klamath Falls is also in that situation, and I've been traveling to Klamath Falls for 25 years for work as a court reporter with the bankruptcy court, and I know they have an air quality problem. Medford and Prineville are well on their way to having the same problem. So this is a tremendous way to start to address that. We have very poor communities who can't afford to buy the new clean burning wood stoves. And Andy's going to tell you, I hope, because I talked to him in the hallway and he told me this by email, we got a federal grant to add some money into the program, because you're not giving us any, because there isn't any, but we've got some federal money. And we're going to keep working on getting some stimulus dollars to help put into this program, because I just think it's a terrific way to help reduce air pollution in our communities and help families who can't afford to upgrade to a clean burning stove. So I just want to be here to see my baby go all the way through, and thank you for all of your hard work, everyone, on this. And I'll let Andy go through the technical details, because I don't need to hear those.
Well, are you going to stay, or are you?
No, I have to go to my committee of public safety.
So the question I have for you is, would you be interested in carrying this to the Senate floor?
Oh, I'd be delighted to. Madam Chair, I don't get to do that very often because I'm not on policy committees anymore.
Since you shepherded this through last session, and this is unfinished business the way I see it, certainly that's the chair's prerogative. If you're interested, I would be happy to do that.
Well, if your committee chooses to pass it out today, I'd be delighted to carry it. So
right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
All right.
Hey, Andy, you're up. So you're going to walk us through the dash twos, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for DEQ. And before she leaves, I just want to thank Senator Walker also for all her hard work on this bill. So I'll just quickly walk you through the Dash 2 amendments. If you could turn to page 1, lines 14 to 15. Oh, and I should note that this is a replacement bill, so a lot of the amended text in here is from the original bill. So I'll just point out the changes in the Dash 2. If you look at lines 14 and 15, we're adding some language to the purpose to include compliance. It's important that if we remove an uncertified stove, that we ensure that we have compliance with that requirement. If you turn to page 2, we have on lines 1 through 4 and also on lines 20 through 25, there's some new language to ensure that we stay as consistent as possible with EPA's regulations. It's really important for the wood stove dealers that we have uniform requirements, and so this language was added because we know EPA is about to update their standards for wood stoves to ensure that we give them time to do that before we jump in and make any changes. So, and we've committed to the wood stove industry that we're going to stay as consistent as possible with federal regulations. On page 3, lines 10 through 14, we've revised the definition of a masonry heater. This is at the request of contractors who install those, and it's to make it consistent with the ASTM standards. Still on page 3, lines 29 to 30, we've revised the definition of a masonry fireplace slightly, and similarly on page 4, lines 11 through 16, we've added a definition of a central wood-fired furnace. So these are just to help with the implementation of the bill. On page 7, we have added a few new uses for the wood stove fund. As Senator Walker just mentioned, we have no new funding going into this fund, although we were successful in getting some federal grant money to help with wood stove changeouts. But in the future, if we ever are able to have some money for this fund, we would add some funding for public education and enforcement so that we would ensure that uncertified stoves aren't illegally installed. Page 9, we have some new language, and you'll see the same language show up in three other places. It's on lines 17 through 30, and this section deals with installation of used uncertified stoves, and it prohibits used uncertified stoves from being installed in a home. And this language clarifies that we will have a grace period. If EPA comes out with a new, more stringent standard for wood stoves, but you have just purchased one that last year was complying, you wouldn't be asked to immediately remove it from your home, or you would still be able to install it in a home until it's 15 years old. So the idea here was just that a homeowner shouldn't get caught in the crossfire when EPA updates their standards, and we provide a 15-year grace period. The same language on page 10, lines 11 through 24, applying to the sale of a used stove, so a grace period there. The same language again on page 11, lines 11 through 24, applying the grace period for the requirement to remove a stove, an uncertified stove from a home upon sale. Also on page 11, lines 26 and 27, we exempted masonry heaters and masonry fireplaces from the requirement for removal upon sale of home. It's not practical to remove a fireplace like a wood stove. On page 13, lines 23 through 30, and continuing on the next page to line 6, the same language allowing a grace period wood stove curtailment program. So if the state implemented a wood stove curtailment program, it would have two phases, and these stoves that were recently they were certified stoves last year, but now EPA has updated the standards. They get the grace period as well from curtailment programs. I believe, Madam Chair, that is all of the amendments. So they're fairly technical in nature and don't really change the substance, but the main thing was providing those grace periods.
Okay. Thank you, Andy, for that very thorough walkthrough, since this was a significant rewrite of the bill. And at first, I just want to thank you again for your hard work and for all of the stakeholders that provided input to make this a better bill. And I know that you worked very hard to accommodate their concerns, and we certainly appreciate that, and I know they do as well. So I want to see if there are any questions on the amendments.
Madam Chair.
Senator House.
I appreciate the hard work in rewriting this, but I'm wondering if you could just like to keep this in perspective, go back to square one and walk us through briefly what this looks like to a person who has one of these, you know, a transaction. And
sort of the on-the-ground implementation.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, so the primary provision in this bill requires removal of an uncertified stove upon sale of home, and that's so, as Senator Walker was mentioning, especially in our areas that are violating the fine particulate standard, we will gradually replace our stock of older, higher-polluting stoves with newer, cleaner stoves. If you had one of these stoves in your home and you sold your house, then your realtor would notify you of the requirement. There's a whole section in the back of this bill that includes notification in the realtor's uniform disclosure form. And then if you had an uncertified stove in the home, you'd have to remove it. Or you could negotiate with the buyer that would be their responsibility. But absent that, it would be the seller's responsibility. We've worked with wood stove dealers, they typically will take your old stove back and destroy it for you and take it in for recycling. But you have other options. You can take it to recycling yourself. It's not required to purchase a new stove, but you are required to remove the uncertified stove. That's the basics of it.
Okay, I understand all that. I just wanted to kind of hear whether that's changed or not. And if I could follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up?
Not all home sales are done through a realtor. Some are land sales contracts or just two owners that wouldn't. I mean, is there a place in this legislation that addresses that?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, not directly addressed, but we would address that in our implementation. We're going to have an outreach program. We'll have information on our website. We'll have fact sheets and materials that will be available. The point would be for us, it would be our responsibility to get the information to the homeowners upon sale and if it wasn't a realtor transaction.
And
follow up.
If that's not done, if two owners agree to do this and bypass this, what's the mechanism?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, there's a specific protection for homeowners in that case that the bill specifically says that the sale of the home is not affected by noncompliance with the requirement to remove the wood stove, so it doesn't affect the transaction at all. But it would be a violation of the requirements, and it would be subject to civil penalties if we identified it. So in all likelihood, if it came to our attention and we found that a stove hadn't been removed, we would provide the homeowner with notice and they would remove it with a warning. But it would potentially be subject to a civil penalty.
Thank you.
Member Broquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you expand the definition of the civil penalty? How much are we talking here?
Madam Chair, Senator Broquist, I'd have to probably get back to you on that exact number. The way our civil penalties work, there's a matrix in our rules, and there's a higher matrix for a large industrial company, and there's a much lower matrix for a homeowner or a small business. So this would fall into our lower cost matrix, and then there are all kinds of mitigating factors that are taken into account and coming up with an actual penalty, but it wouldn't be a very high penalty in this case.
Follow up, could you define high? I mean, we're doing 10,000 yesterday, 25,000. Are we talking 500 or just rough ballpark?
More like the latter, Senator Broquist.
Okay. One follow-up, Madam Chair. Could you just run down the fiscal? It says it's not anticipated in the governor's budget. And then you mentioned that the grant was for wood stove changeouts, not rulemaking.
Correct. Madam Chair, Senator Broquist, because we'll be using, this is one of the primary strategies that we'll be using to meet the federal air quality standards, we're going to redirect existing staff to work on this. We have staff that are dedicated to working on developing strategies and plans to meet federal air quality standards. And so now that we have two new non-attainment areas in the state, in Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge and several others that are on the cusp, we're going to dedicate those existing staff to this work. So they will stop doing other non-attainment-related work until this rulemaking is done.
One final question, Madam Chair.
Final follow-up.
That assumes that the rumor floating around that co-chairs are asking for a 30% cut is not implemented?
Madam Chair, Senator Broquist, even in that circumstance, we would have resources to do this work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. And somebody just handed up a question, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but hopefully you will, Andy, because you seem to know the answers to much of this elements in this bill, since you've worked on this for a long, long time. The question was, and I'm not sure I'm reading this right, because the handwriting is a little vague. Yeah, does line 21 on page 7 apply only to solid fuel?
What does stoves.
That say? Stoves, okay.
Page 7, line 21.
Page 7, line 21. Vent-free heating appliances. Question is, does it apply only to solid fuel stoves? I guess versus fuel.
I'm not sure I understand the question, Madam Chair, but page 7, line 21, the language on exempting vent-free heating appliances.
Mm-hmm.
This has to do with grant programs. If we had funding in the fund, that we would replace, once a stove was removed, you could replace your heating with any type of heating system that was either a certified wood stove or a pellet stove or a natural gas system or oil or any other type of heating system, except for a vent-free heating appliance, which would be like for example, a propane heater that was, because of the concern about carbon monoxide inside, those can only be used in a vented space.
Okay. Does that answer your question? Great. Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Well, we have Andy up here before we release him.
Release him.
Yes. Okay, with that, we are in a work session, and I will take a motion.
I move that we adopt the -2 amendments dated March 27, 2009 for Senate Bill 102.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated March 27, 2009. Is there any discussion? Senator Broquist?
Nope, no discussion.
Okay. I saw the finger go up there.
I'm anticipating.
Okay. Is there any objection?
Correct.
Okay, Senator Broquist.
All right.
With that, the amendment is adopted.
And, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 102 as amended by the -2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Przanski moves Senate Bill 102 as amended with the -2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Broquist?
No.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Haft?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Excused.
Chair Dean Phillips.
Aye. That, the motion carries, and I will assign Senator Walker as the carrier in absentia. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 102. And and I apologize because I forgot to mention at the beginning of the hearing that we actually will be carrying over the work session on Senate Bill 103 because we do not have all the paperwork for that. And so, Andy, you are truly released from your adjournment here.
Carried over to Tuesday?
Yeah, it's carried over till Tuesday, April 7th. So I want to make sure folks know that. And then last on our work session, Senate Bill 513, we'll open up the work session on Senate Bill 513.
Chair Dingenfelder and committee members, Senate Bill 513, we heard on the 24th, it establishes that it is policy of the state to support the maintenance, enhancement, and restoration of ecosystem services, encourages state agencies to adopt and incorporate adaptive management mechanisms. You have a dash 3 amendment in front of you that includes the text of the bill that we actually heard testimony on the 24th. The only change is there is an emergency clause that has been added, and that's due to the fact that there was an appropriation of $120,000 effective, I believe, in June, and this would make it so the bill takes effect now.
Okay.
Or else as soon as it's signed by law.
So just so you know, we heard testimony on the dash 3s, and so the dash 2s, so the only difference between the dash 3s and the dash 2s is the addition of the emergency clause that you just heard.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, do we have anybody? I think we have Sarah Vickerman who would like to come up and speak on the. Do you want to come up, Sarah? Just quickly, if you wanted to just say a few words on the dash 3 since I.
The only difference is emergency clause?
Yes.
So you don't need to
say anything. Okay.
Unless you have any questions.
Does anyone have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Okay. Then I'll take a motion.
I'll move for the adoption of the dash 3 amendments dated March 31st. To Senate Bill 513.
Okay, Senator Prezonsky moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated March 31st, 2009. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? All right, seeing none, the Dash 3s are adopted.
And Madam Chair, this time I will move the Senate Bill 513 as amended by the Dash 3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means as prior reference.
Okay. Senator Prezonsky moves Senate Bill 513 as amended with the dash 3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and it's referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Okay, Senator Boklis.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to comment, I note the fiscal here, and,
yeah.
And while it's not as large, it should go into Ways and Means to be considered.
Yeah, it's going to Ways and Means. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Boklis?
Aye.
Senator
Prezonsky? Aye.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Excused? Aye. That the motion carries and or passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means, so we don't need a carrier. Is that correct?
Correct.
With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 513, and now we can move on to our public hearing portion. And our first bill that we're going to hear is Senate Bill 787. I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 787. And Beth, if you can provide us with an overview, please.
Chair Dingenfelder and committee members, Senate Bill 787 finds that all water within Oregon belongs to the public, requires that before the state spends public money on new water supply development projects, existing water supplies must be managed responsibly. Just for the record, also, we have received additional written testimony before the hearing.
Okay. And let me see how many books we have. How many sign up sheets? Is that it? Okay, so I think we'll be okay. But I am going to ask people to keep their comments brief because we do have some members that have to leave, and I want to make sure that we get to hear everybody. So on 787, we actually only have two people signed up.
No.
Is that correct? Oh. All right, that's it. So how many?
This is page 8, and they're bringing up
all right.
One for the next one.
All right, hold on. We may be timing people because we've got more pages coming. Yeah, okay. We are getting out the timer. You will have 3 minutes maximum, and I will use my prerogative as chair to cut you off if we are running over. With that, I will ask David Moskowitz to come up and testify. To start with, I'm just going to start calling off on these sheets. David Moskowitz, Mark Landauer, and Patrick Griffins. Griffiths. Sorry. Sorry, Patrick, if you're here. Okay, I'm not seeing people come up. Come on up. And you're all going to get 3 minutes. Just because I'm calling you up doesn't mean that you all signed up for or against or whatever, but I'm calling up in the order you signed up. And certainly if you came from over 100 miles like Patrick did, we want to make sure you get up here promptly. So, David, why don't you go ahead? We've got the timer here and get started.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here testifying on behalf of the Native Fish Society in support of Senate Bill 787. I think you're going to hear from a number of folks who have been working on this bill for some time, and I'll let them get into the details of the bill. We believe that the context here is that water storage, there's a rush to find water to store because of demands of growing population, growing economic use, greater needs for fish and wildlife, and also adaptive changes due to climate change. Taking water out of streams or out of the ground to use is an expensive proposition, and those who are going to use that water are going to increasingly look towards the public for help with funding, whether it's through bonding, whether it's through grants. And our belief is that if people are going to use public money for water storage projects, then there needs to be some due diligence set in place so that we are using conservation as the first source of supply. It's very similar to the way energy is treated. Conservation needs to be the first source of supply. And this bill will ask those who wish to take water out for storage to show that they're doing due diligence in terms of their conservation efforts, implementing their conservation efforts, making sure that plumbing codes, building codes, making sure that there's water efficiency plans that are in place that are showing that they're saving water. That's the essence of this bill. And you're going to hear from a lot more people who know a lot more about this, and I'm going to cut my time short at that point and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, David. Whoever wants to go next? Patrick, welcome.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Patrick Griffiths. I'm the Water Resources Coordinator for the City of Bend. I also want you to know that I work very closely with all of the environmental and other cities, tribes, and others in the Chute Basin, as I think you know. And we're very successful in putting a lot of water back in stream. We are very successful in working collaboratively to not only fund these efforts, but work with state and federal partners in order to work on these projects. We do believe conservation is a significant and important part of our supply options for the future, and the City of Bend is on its third iteration of filing and getting an approved water management and conservation plan. With that said, we did look over the details of the bill. Without spending a lot of time on those right now, we feel that if a city has gone through the effort to get an approved water management conservation plan in place, that that should basically qualify it to get any state funding to do other good work in association with WMCP and other partners. And we feel that a regional approach that prioritizes and invests in conservation really is the best guidance for figuring out which projects are the best in a region to do good work in that basin. And with that, I'll cut my testimony short and stand by for any questions. And again, thank you for the time.
Okay. And thank you for coming here today. I know you came a long way, but you get three bills to choose from testifying on.
Good afternoon. Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association, also representing the Oregon Association of Water Utilities today. We'd like to express our concerns with Senate Bill 787. Currently, as Patrick mentioned, municipal water suppliers must complete what are called water management and conservation plans. These plans are required statutorily, and their guidance or the contents of those plans are guided by Oregon Administrative Rule. Suppliers, obviously, we support conservation and responsible use of water. In the plans, we are required to show that we have considered a range of water management and conservation actions to minimize the need to develop or extend existing water rights. Conservation must be considered as an alternative to increased development of water. Senate Bill 787 creates an additional layer of requirements in statute on top of the existing rules, and these new requirements will result in delays, confusion, and unnecessary expenses to water suppliers who are already employing prudent management and conservation efforts. Another problem with the bill is that it will disproportionately impact many of the smaller water providers in the state. Many small water providers have very few resources to conduct these plans. I think you'll get a sense in a little while as to how much these plans cost and the detail that is involved with them. At the end of the day, we support conservation, we support responsible use and putting water to a beneficial use, but this bill is confusing, it's expensive, redundant, unbalanced, and frankly unnecessary. Thank you.
Thank you. I do have a question. It seems to be we've lost several members. I know what you guys said, but scared off my committee members. No. I heard you say about the concerns about costs, but if you're investing in conservation, aren't you saving for municipality, you know, saving for the long term as far as being able to extend the life of existing facilities?
Indeed. You know, through conservation efforts, obviously, we're saving water, we're saving utility payers, increased rates. But the problem with the bill as designed now, we're going to have to unnecessarily expend new monies to go through some of the requirements that are contained in the bill, and we would say that those are oftentimes redundant, and there's no reason to do two separate studies when there's one that's already in existence, there's familiarity with it, and it tends to be very exhaustive.
That noise, by the way, is because somebody probably has their cell phone on and is up by the microphone, so just a reminder to turn those off. I appreciate the comment. One thing that occurred to me is that, obviously, if that's already being done, then certainly I think that should be taken under consideration as part of the analysis, but appreciate you bringing that forward.
If I could reply to that question as well, Chair Dingfelder, again, David Moskowitz.
Since we've got a couple more minutes here.
The bill has several exemptions for projects at a cost under $10,000, which hopefully will minimize the impact of some of the smaller districts. Also, if the municipalities or agricultural unit, whoever's required to do, I guess it's just municipalities are required to do the water conservation management plans. If they're already doing that work, then half of their work is already done. This puts it in statute and shows that they're taking action on those plans.
All right. Thank you for those comments, gentlemen. And just a comment, by the way, I just left the Water Resources Department budget hearings where the 30% cuts are to cut all of the water conservation positions along with the water measurement positions. And the position to review these water conservation plans would be eliminated from the agency's budget. So that certainly is cause for concern. Okay, next up, Lorna Stickle, Anita Winkler, and Peggy Lynch. Not trying to be the bearer of bad news here, but I wish I had better news. Yes. And if you have written testimony, please, to the committee administrator, and we will start the clock with Lorna, because I know she's so efficient. I'll let you sit down first before you start the clock.
Nice of you, Peggy. So, I mean, Senator Greenfield.
Okay.
Okay, City of Portland is providing some very brief comments on...
And state your name, please.
Oh, sorry.
Even though I know...
Lorna Stickle, Portland Water Bureau, planner extraordinaire. Okay. We're providing some brief comments that would put into statute, as you know, already know what it's for applying for funds. And overall, the city generally supports the concept. We don't even necessarily object to putting the standards of Division 86 or some of them into statute. The issue that we have identified with this bill as drafted is that the wording is different than the administrative rules, and there are no exclusions for the very small entities or a reduced set of considerations for entities serving under 7,500 population. We believe these should be repeated or continued on if it's going to be put into statute, because under our wholesale contract arrangements, we require have all of our wholesalers that meet their above or within that same set of rules for Division 86 to submit a conservation plan, whether they would have to do so with the state or not. So we would rather that we just stuck with the way the rules, the way they were. And in addition, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there is an out for all programs listed in Section 3 under Subsection 2C, whereas the Division 86 rules don't allow an out for the mandatory programs that are listed in your Section 3, A through F. So that, in some ways, this bill is weaker than the rules themselves. And finally, it would be reasonable to create a provision that says, as was already said by the earlier folks, that if you haven't approved a WMCP, that really ought to be good enough. So,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Peggy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. As you know, the League has recently completed a study of Oregon's water laws and rules. As we expend public monies to assure that we have safe, clean water for all beneficial uses in the state, we must husband our resources and target them to projects that recognize our first best value is conservation of water. It may be necessary to fund new water supply projects to assure we have water during times of water scarcity. However, we must assure that our limited public funds are used for projects that stretch those funds and limited water supplies by assuring that conservation, efficiency, and good management measures are implemented before new projects are funded. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you guys are all going way under 3 minutes. So efficient. Don't
Chair,
think that you can have it all, though, Anita, at the end.
Chair Dinko.
I was going to say, this may be the shortest panel that you get all day. I'm Anita Winkler, Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress, and you have written testimony from me. I'm going to just highlight a couple of pieces, but I want you to know that I'm presenting this basically on behalf of the irrigation manager for the Central Oregon Irrigation District. He couldn't come over today, and he's responsible for most of the ideas and certainly the examples in the testimony. I just want to spend a couple of minutes mostly focusing on a request that we have for some amendments that would allow us to support the bill. I'm not going to go through some various language problems we had. That's not worth spending your time on. It can be sorted out as we go later on. But this bill would require, the way it's written, would require every irrigation district as a supplier of agricultural water to measure every one of their water users. And it's just impractical in an irrigation district. So we're asking that it's Section 4, Sub 2, A, and B, be amended to exclude an agriculture water delivery system that measures at the point of diversion from the requirements to measure every water user. Secondly, similar to the cities, we're asking that an ag water supplier who has an agriculture water management and conservation plan that's been approved be construed to meet the requirements of Section 4.2D. Again, it seems kind of redundant to have to go through two processes when these plans are already in place and identify all the information asked for in that section. There's some descriptions of some of the issues that the requirement for measuring every water user creates in the operations of a district, but one of them, which I think is sort of unusual to hear about, and I'd like to just explain that a little bit. Often, districts are now delivering water to smaller land parcels than originally designed, and the district's point of delivery is at one point for that entire group of properties, and they measure at that point of delivery to that entire group. It's impossible to measure every water user within that group because they rotate. They have some sort of agreement that somebody gets water on this day and then a future day and so on. So the key is not every water user. The key is at the main points. We measure generally at the canals. We know what's going down each canal. We know what's going down each lateral, so we know what we're delivering to people, let alone what we're diverting at the point of diversion. We've discussed some of these amendments with some sponsors of the bill. They've indicated their willingness to work with us, and we'd like a little time to get that language squared away so we can bring it back to you with an agreement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anita. Just a quick question before I let this panel go, and it's probably directed most to you because it's about the agricultural water conservation plans, because my understanding is those are voluntary, not required.
I heard that testimony in the Ways and Means Subcommittee the other day. They are required for districts to do certain activities, and certainly if they were part of this bill, they'd be required to do this. You could either go one way or the other. But the Bureau of Reclamation requires them for all of their districts. Most of our non-Bureau districts of any size have done them as well because they've applied for Bureau money
or they've been part of some other effort that they're going, or frankly, they found they're a really good management tool. They're required to participate in the allocation of conserved water program, which allows a district who has conserved, say, 100 CFS of water to put that to new lands. It's the only way you can get it to new lands, so long as they dedicate at least 25% of that water to in-stream. So most of our districts have done it because they're participating in that program.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I appreciate your willingness to work on some amendments to this bill, and we'll probably be taking up on that. Thanks. Thank you very much. Next, Jeff Stone, Katie Fast, and actually, I think what we'll do is have Dan Eisenbeiss come up with you all. Welcome. Katie, why don't you go first? Okay. Let the ladies go first.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation testifying today with some concerns in opposition to Senate Bill 787. The first issue that I'd like to touch on is, I guess the positive piece of this is that it creates a water development supply fund, which is something that the Oregon Farm Bureau is very supportive of seeing pushed forward this session. However, it just creates a fund, but it does not talk about the administration or the purpose or how that fund will be granting out and delivering dollars. So we'd like to see more details to the fund added to the legislation. But it does go into a great deal of detail on the constraints to applying to the fund and what you must do before you can qualify for funding mechanisms. Also, it puts forward rulemaking and work for the agency to do at Water Resources Department. And this is an agency that in this economic times has many challenges getting through their budget cycle, and we'll probably be seeing cuts to the agency. So I would say my first concern is that we're creating a fund with no money, but we will be asking the Water Resources Department to expend staff time and resources to write rules on qualifications to that fund. Additionally, while we are supportive of conservation projects, we see this bringing individual irrigators who are applying to the fund under the water management and conservation plans that municipal and irrigation districts do currently. And finally, I know you're short on time, I'd also like to add that this legislation talks about water supply projects. And in terms of this body precedent setting and moving water supply projects forward, they include conservation, reuse, and storage projects. And I see this legislation as limiting conservation projects from qualifying for the water supply fund because they may not meet that pre-qualification under the measurement and conservation previously, because those are the work that the individual irrigators or districts will be applying for to move forward on their water they manage. And so it really limits, I see, conservation projects from applying and participating in the fund. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Why don't we hear from Jeff, and then we'll take questions from everybody, or Jeff and Dan.
Madam Chair, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. I won't bear to repeat much of what has already been said, and we have extensive comments and, in fact, quite a few open questions about just wanting to clarify some of the language that's in the bill. During the interim, the OAN and many of us up here at this panel participated in several work groups. The benefit of that is a collaboration that allows municipal, agricultural, tribal, and environmental interests to come together around one common set of what we want to do with water policy. And conservation was a key topic. And the stakeholder groups talked about in detail bonus points or something along those lines for certain types of projects that have different factors, including a commitment to conservation. This prioritization is, I think, helpful. And so when you look at the whole of water policy, a combination of water conservation and supply is important. Senate Bill 787, while we have several concerns about it, can provide an opportunity to collaborate. And through a balanced approach of meaningful, integrated water supply strategy, conservation and supply will not be seen as competing interests, but pieces of the same puzzle. So I would ask for your careful consideration of this and its long-term implications. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Dan. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to comment in opposition to the bill as it's been drafted and introduced. Let me first say that, as you've already heard today, municipalities strongly support conservation efforts and invest a great deal of time and money in conserving water. That said, this bill before you today and the eligibility requirements that it spells out does not appear to deliver any sort of meaningful increase in the effectiveness of conservation efforts that are already required of municipalities. I've handed out the guidebook that the League and some other organizations published after the Water Management and Conservation Plan rules were updated in 2002, going into effect in 2003, so that you have something to refer to understand, at least in less technical terms than the actual administrative rules themselves, what cities are already doing. We're concerned that the bill as drafted presents a very similar but different set of requirements for municipalities, creating confusion and creating extra work both for municipalities and for the Water Resources Department in terms of review. In addition, it requires measures from Oregon's smallest municipal providers, those under 7,500 people, that are not required under WMCPs, even though many of those communities have completed WMCPs and are invested in meeting the benchmarks that they've established for their updates. Just one example that I want to note in terms of the different requirements between the bill and the administrative rules is the exemptions are stated differently. Right now, under administrative rule, cities provide documentation of the need for an exemption. Under the bill, it would require a finding from the Water Resources Department. Also, Section 7 of the bill requires that Water Resources conduct rulemaking to establish guidelines for implementation of this bill, just another layer of work and probably requiring a staff person devoted to this at a time when, as already noted by Chair Dingfelder, the governor's recommended budget calls for cutting the general fund position that processes water management and conservation plans. So we would certainly urge the committee to consider acknowledging the work that's already been conducted through water management and conservation plans and making sure that those municipalities with approved plans are, in a de facto sense, eligible for water supply development funding from the state. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, I do have one question for you, Dan, because I'm very familiar with this, but I just want to mention for folks that this is, you know, really good bedtime reading, but seriously, it's very interesting because this is the guidance for producing conservation plans that you've been hearing about up here for municipalities. There's a separate guidance for
irrigation districts,
which is, I think, available through the department as well. Is that correct? But you are correct. Today in the committee, just previous to this, we were discussing some cuts, and we're going to have the agency come up here in a minute about, you know, not even having staff to review these plans. So the question I have is, you know, certainly my city, the city of Portland, which you've heard from, that has a lot of staff, and a lot of very capable staff, but not all, you know, municipalities have the technical assistance or the wherewithal to be able to implement those plans. So if you have any comments on, as we're looking at, I guess I don't see it as a conflict. If we have something in statute that reinforces what's in here, especially as resources are going to be diminishing for the agency to implement those rules.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I guess that our area of greatest concern is that rather than simply pointing toward the water management and conservation plan requirements that are already in place, this bill restates some of those requirements, but uses different terminology to do so, and therefore it's a distinct requirement.
which is going to cause confusion, and it's also going to cause municipalities and the department to revisit good work that's already been done.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. Appreciate that. Okay. Thank you very much. And next, we'll hear from Nikki Iverson, City Hillsborough. Is Nikki here? Tom Wolf and John DeVoe. And then last but not least, we will hear from the agency. Do you want to come up? Okay. Welcome, Nikki. Why don't you go first?
Good to Madam Chair, members of the committee, yep. Nikki Iverson, City of Hillsborough, and the Joint Water Commission.
And you can move this so you don't have to lean over.
Sorry, John.
That's why they're mobile.
Just so you know, I'm representing the Joint Water Commission today. That's a water supply agency representing the cities of Hillsborough, Beaverton, Forest Grove, Tigard, and the Tualatin Valley Water District. We serve approximately 400,000 people in Washington County. And I won't go over the similar testimony that's already been submitted by Mark and Daniel, but I just wanted to make a few points. This is a WMCP by one of our members. I have a couple of them up here. It's not a minor effort. I'm currently a project manager doing one of these plans for the entire Joint Water Commission. One of these plans costs about, at a minimum, $100,000, and that doesn't include staff time that goes into putting the data together as well. One of our biggest concerns is that this bill seems to have the intent of putting the rules of the plans into statute. However, they seem a little different, and we're worried that if they're duplicative but not quite the same, we'll have to do another effort. These plans are already required on a five-year basis, and so by the time that we take to put these plans together, or time that's taken away from actually being able to implement innovative conservation plans in our communities. And there's a couple other points I'd like to make. First of all, Hillsborough conservation is not one of the cheapest alternatives. I think that's a common misconception by many people. Hillsborough alone spends $750,000 a year replacing aging infrastructure, and that's just one component of the plans. I have also submitted a condensed version of the guidebook along with our testimony, and this is what the state actually checks off each box of the attachment to approve one of these plans. And so we have extensive things we already have to do, and one of the things that we're worried about is that this would be an additional effort on top of that. If we can make it consistent with the water management conservation plans, that would ease the burden on our communities as well. And that also municipalities are already serving the public interest through conservation, and we are very committed to that. The JWC has seen savings, water savings, from 15% to 20% just since 2002. And even though we've had significant water savings, we have not. It's still difficult to keep up with the growing demands of our communities, including industry. Hillsborough with Intel, a new Solar World chip manufacturer, Genentech, other types of companies that require water. When we do see water savings, we also see industries coming to our communities, especially green industries that I think we're all interested in seeing, using large amounts of water. And so we are just wanted to make the point that we're very committed to this, but it's not a small effort. So
thank you for coming here. And I do have a question, having worked with the JWC for many years, and I haven't read that particular plan, but if
it takes a while, yeah.
But I do know you are committed to conservation. As far as the goals that are set out, do you have regular goals that you talked about 15% to 20% savings, but do you have conservation goals that you're reporting back to your board and benchmarks for meeting those?
Each agency sets their own conservation goals, but our biggest, we just try to get the best that we can get. Since we've already seen 15% to 20%, we believe that that's a pretty high standard in the state, and so that we feel, you know, additional savings might be difficult because the more what you've already saved through plumbing code fixtures and line replacements, the more you save, the longer you go into savings, it's harder to achieve that same percentage, if that makes any sense. You kind of get the best bang for your buck up front in the first, couple decades of conservation. But after you implement certain savings devices, it's very difficult to see that same kind of savings over time.
So I'm just trying to...
That makes sense.
Well, so is the answer that you do have set goals that are part of that plan?
Some of the agencies do and some do not.
And so when you say some of the agencies, because you make up several agencies.
Well, some of the agencies have set percentages But because not like Tuolumne Valley Water District, for instance, has a set percentage. They've looked at the costs of three different types of percentage of goals, and they're all in the millions of dollars. And so, you know, their boards, based on those certain percentages, they make policy decisions on that. I haven't looked at all the other agencies to see what their specific goals are, though.
Okay, and are they weighing those goals for the cost of conservation versus new supply?
Yes. But it isn't a cheap thing, and we can't generally make the amount of savings we need by the time we need the water for our growing communities.
So. Okay. All right. I might want to continue with you offline on that because I do have a couple more questions.
That'd be great.
We have two other bills up.
Thank you.
So, Tom, why don't you go? You were signed up next.
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, representing the 3,000 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state of Oregon. Trout Unlimited is very concerned about in-stream flows. We, with their permission, we borrowed the concept of Water Watch a number of years ago, and we have what's called the Eastern and Western Water Project, where we take what Water Watch does and do it in approximately 28 other states across the country working to protect in-stream flows. So we support this bill, 787. I think it's a very good bill. And it's interesting that I would follow Nikki in testimony because I happen to live in the city of Hillsboro and have for the last 20 years. I've seen it grown from a town of approximately 25,000 people 20 years ago to a town pushing 90,000 right now. It demands and uses a lot of water. I have sat on the Tualatin Watershed Council. I've sat on the Clean Water Services Advisory Committee. I am very involved with water issues in the Tualatin Basin now. So I would disagree with some of my learned predecessor there. I think that we do need this bill. We do need to think. We do need to have efficient ways to deal with water use because Tualatin, the Washington County is only going to get bigger. We're projecting in the city of Hillsboro to be at about 125,000 by the year 2020. We're projecting that Washington County will pass Multnomah County in the number of people by the year 2030. We are a state that's very attractive to a lot of people. We need to have clear, efficient ways of requiring people to manage money, and we feel that Trout Unlimited feels that Senate Bill 787 does that. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is John DeVoe. I'm the executive director of Water Watch. I'm appreciating the testimony I'm hearing today. It sounds like there's a spirit of collaboration and a willingness to work together on conservation and efficiency as important issues as we look at Oregon's water future. And we're willing to do that. I want to point out, though, that the notion that water management and conservation plans are somehow being, there's a redundancy here in this bill. That's not really the case because those plans only have to be done for water rights that are post-1998 or that are under an extension process right now. So water rights that predate 1998 or are not involved in an extension process typically do not have to go through a water management and conservation plan process. And that's my understanding. The other point I would make is the bill does not seek to simply duplicate the requirements of the current Water Management and Conservation Plan Division 86 rules. What it seeks is actual implementation of those elements as a condition of eligibility for public money for new storage projects. Conservation and efficiency typically are the most inexpensive and cost-effective ways of developing new supplies of water. In California, there have been studies done on this. In the Central Valley Project, you can conserve an acre foot of water for about $150. If you develop new storage to get that same acre foot of water, it can cost anywhere from $4,000 to $8,000 per acre foot. You can look at a project like the Black Rock Project up on the Yakima, which is now penciling out at about $6,000 plus per acre foot. We can conserve water much more cheaply than $6,000 to $8,000 an acre foot, and we ought to be doing that as we look towards Oregon's water future. We are happy to work with any of the user groups on exemptions, on exempting small providers, on exempting certain types of projects. It was certainly not the intention of this bill to pick up conservation and reuse type projects. And we can certainly work on amendments with folks to write those types of issues out of the bill. That was not the intention of the bill. We do believe, however, that the first source of supply as Oregon goes forward ought to be conservation and efficiency. And we ought to have a demonstration that one's water house is in order before an entity comes to the public and asks for public money to develop new supplies, new storage supplies of water. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen and ladies. And I am going to ask the department if they can come up. Is there anybody else, by the way, that did not sign up on this bill that would like to come up, testify? I know we have some written testimony from the, is that for this bill? From the Cattlemen's Association?
From the Cattlemen's Association,
yes.
As well as we've received a lot of emails and things like that. That
okay.
Compiling.
So we have some written testimony for the record as well. Welcome. Hello. It's Water Day.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, and thank you for the opportunity to make a few comments on Senate Bill 787. I wanted to back up for just a moment and stress that there certainly is a need for grants and loans and public monies for these water development projects that we've been talking about this afternoon. We have certainly noted that with the planning grants and the feasibility study grants programs that we launched just this past year. In 2008, both of those programs were oversubscribed with requests for assistance totaling much more than the amount of funds that we had available to give out. So the need is definitely there as these communities are looking towards economic development, population growth projections, climate change, and other issues that are coming their way. But also, and just as importantly, it's important to have environmental parameters and protections on these programs because we want to make sure that we are spending our public monies on the very best projects that we can. It appears that the requirements in this particular bill may be cost prohibitive, however, particularly with the requirement of completion. The implementation of the items on this list. And I would like to echo some of the earlier comments about using the water management and conservation plans as a blueprint or a possible approach for this conversation. This is a model that we use today in discussion with water users. And what we're doing there is we're asking them to consider and then document for us their thought process and their approach to several categories, including pardon my voice, future demand projections, conservation pricing, and perhaps the use of that, rebates, retrofits, and equipment switch out, more efficient processes, and public outreach and education as part of their conservation efforts. Not all of these items fit well in every community, and so what we're asking as part of this process is for folks to tell us what their thought process was and tell us why these pieces may or may not work for them and what they have decided to move forward with, not that they've necessarily implemented every single item on this list. Our key concern, of course, with this bill is the fiscal impact that it would represent for the department because it would be a new workload or an extra workload for us. One of the things I think this bill anticipates is that there would be funding in the first place to give out to communities, that there would be grant or loan monies available, and that there would be an FTE to run the program that perhaps would be in this bill or future bill. That aside, the pieces that are in this bill would also require an additional staff member for us to make sure that we have reviewed and feel comfortable with the documentation that comes in the door as part of these applications for public monies. So thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'm happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you, Brenda. I know it's been a rough day for you with the bad budget news and going through the budget earlier today, but I do have a question for you. If you can comment on, for both the municipal water conservation plans and the agricultural, how does the department ensure implementation of these plans? It's one thing to submit a plan, and being a planner, I know that very well, but certainly the proof is in the pudding as far as implementing these plans. And what do you have in place that the sort of that you can do checks or feedback that you can get? Because obviously doing a plan is great, but making sure that the what's outlined in the plan and the tools that are in that plan are actually put to use.
I would say for the most part, Madam Chair, the review and the comfort level with these plans is a lot of it's going to take place sort of in the office environment. And so a lot of that is through the phone calls and the sort of colleague-to-colleague check-in and the documentation that comes in and the paper trail auditing that takes place. Now, of course, we do have folks in the field, and they're available to help us with some of that work. And, in fact, the Water Management Conservation Plan processors do have occasion to go out themselves every once in a while, but a physical inspection of the type I think you're envisioning, where you're actually looking at retrofits of equipment or actual processes in place, is not normally something that those processors will go and audit physically in the field.
Well, and I guess a follow-up to that would be, so do you require follow-up to implementing or how they're meeting benchmarks once this plan is submitted?
There certainly is a fair amount of back and forth, Madam Chair. There are follow-up questions, and as any of the water users in the room can tell you, this is a pretty lengthy process that requires often includes follow-up questions and some auditing and checkups, but again, typically done by phone.
Okay, and if this position is cut, that's not going to occur?
Madam Chair, we currently have two positions in the Water Management Conservation Processing Department. So there's one that's general fund and then one that's completely fee-supported. It's the general fund position that is currently listed on our reductions
list. And that's for the entire state?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Any questions, other questions for the department? All right. Thank you very much, Brenda. Don't go too far because we've got a couple other bills. Okay, with that, I am going to close the public hearing on 787, and the chair will maybe putting together work group on this. So if that's the case, you will be, Beth will notify you and let you know we have everybody who had signed up and certainly would notify you that's taking place. So obviously we need some more discussion on this bill, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 787. Since we're talking about funding, I will open up a hearing on Senate Bill 740. Beth, if you can walk us through that.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Senate Bill 740 requires the Water Resources Department to charge an annual fee of $100 to the holder of a water right set forth in a permit certificate or limited license other than an in-stream right. Again, for the record, there have been additional materials that have been submitted earlier
okay.
this week.
All right. Thank you. And if I can have a sheet, and we'll go back to the 3 minutes. I'll try not to answer any questions. Do I have that
can
sheet?
Can I take it?
I might have it. Okay, we have managed to lose the sign-up sheet. I think I stuck it in the wrong folder. Well, I could tell you it's just about all the same people.
Do
you have the second part?
Okay.
I do know that. Thank you. Okay. Good thing there's a backup. All right. John DeVoe. I'm trying to read this.
Blair Nash.
Blair Nash and Peggy Lynch. I don't know what happened to it. I swear it's just here. Can I use this? Okay. John?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is John DeVoe. I'm the executive.
I just have to say the staff, for the record, stole my sheet, so
very
I was not
good.
Going crazy. You can use that back. Thank you.
Finally,
yes.
I'm the executive director of WaterWatch.
Thank you, John. Sorry about
that. I'd like to start. We just received a handout in the Ways and Means Committee hearing on the Water Resources Department's budget, and I'm holding it up for the committee, and it's a graph showing the decline in department personnel as a result of 30% proposed cuts for the department.
That's the red line?
That's yeah. the red line, correct.
Drops precipitously off the chart.
What we are facing in this state as we try and plan for Oregon's water future, a future that should include economic development, in-stream protection, agriculture, municipal availability of water, all the water needs we have in the state is we're looking at a train wreck. And we're going to have the funding to provide the core capacities of this agency to do its job in all of those aspects of its mission. Senate Bill 740 proposes a modest fee on what the holders of water rights across the state. Water rights, when you apply for them, you pay a fee that covers part of the application procedure to grant or deny the right, but then there is essentially perpetual administration of that right through the system of priority in the field, through the administrative office, and all the other activities that the department has to undertake to manage the system of 87,000 water rights in this state each and every day, each and every year. And as we all know, water rights can be perpetual. So after that initial fee is paid, there is no more payment for the administration of the water right. This bill seeks to create a modest fee on water right holders. It caps those fees at $300 per biennium, regardless of the number of water rights held by an individual, or $1,200, regardless of the water rights held by, say, an institution like an irrigation district or a municipality. For the individual water right holders, that works out to a cap of 21 cents per day if you have multiple water rights, and 13 cents a day if you just have one. I think you're going to hear a lot of opposition to this proposal today, and I guess in closing I would just ask a question. To the people who oppose this proposal, I would ask, what's your proposal? And how do we meet Oregon's water needs and the needs of this agency going forward, which is essential for economic development, for jobs, and for protection of natural resources in this state, without providing this department sufficient capacity to do its job? Thank you.
John. And I will just make a comment, because I just came from hearing this agency's budget committee members. They have 147 employees currently, is that correct?
141.6 after the current biennium cut.
And then they're looking at cutting 47. So that is just about a third of their workforce.
Correct.
If the 30% cuts come in place. And we're looking at almost wholesale elimination of some programs. So I think many of us in this capital are very concerned about that agency's budget and being able to provide the services needed to wisely manage Oregon's water resources. Peggy.
And you've stolen my show, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League believes that the work of the Water Resources Department is critical to the people of Oregon. Because funding for this department comes in great part from the general fund, it is essential that we find reasonable supplemental funding for the department to do its work. Water rights holders now use the waters of the state. Those are our waters, without an annual fee. So requiring a small annual fee would help assure that the right is administered under law and rule, and then monitored. As John mentioned, it's a reasonable expense for such management. We encourage your support for this legislation in order to provide monies for administration and enforcement of those water rights. The waters of the state are critical to all of us, both economically and, frankly, for drinking water as well. We need to have some funding for this department. It is a severe crisis, since this department is one of the few natural resource agencies that is almost entirely dependent upon the general fund, and we know where the general fund is right now. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Okay, I was going to say Mr. Nash.
Yes, I'm Blair Nash. I'm the manager for the Sutherland Water Control District in Sutherland, Oregon. I'm probably the odd man out here for the moment, because my board of directors instructed me to come and express our adamant opposition to Senate Bill 740, which initiates the water right bill. It's true that small fees to start, or they start out small and then they seem to multiply exponentially. And what we're failing to realize is that many times is that these water rights are not free. Many of these districts, many of the water rights have spent thousands, tens of thousands, millions of dollars to develop and maintain these water rights and to maintain the facilities to supply these water rights to people. Our entire society requires these water rights for the economy, for people to drink, for every aspect of life and every bit of our economy. The people of the state own these water rights, or the people of the state own the water, and we granted that authority, or the people of the state granted that authority to the legislature and stuff to manage, to the state, to manage those water rights for us and to grant us back rights, not rents, not leases, rights. And as such, Those rights were granted to individuals, farmers, ranchers, industries, cities, municipalities to manage this most precious resource. These resources aren't free. I would urge you instead to fund these this administrative need and stuff through the general fund more fully. Many of these water rights, in a city you pay a water bill for a drink of water. In the country, we have to drill a well. That well isn't cheap. Some of those wells, 200 or 300 feet deep at $30 or $40 a foot. And then you have to maintain it. The pump goes out in 5-10 years, you have to maintain it. Those water rights aren't free. I guess my closing thought would be, I look back in history and I question sometimes the Revolutionary War. They were only taxing the tea. Are we going to start taxing the very water we drink, the water we use to grow our crops, the water we use to provide industry and municipalities the ability to even produce everything we touch? Water touches. It's taxed continually. And with that, I will quit.
Okay, thank you very much.
Don't leave.
Yeah. Any questions? Okay. Senator Prasansky.
Blair, thank you for coming up, first of all.
You bet.
Second, I've got the first letter that you sent to me or on behalf of the district, March 11th, and then the new one that you've just given us today. There is a, and I don't know if I should be talking about amendments, but there is a dash one, and I just want to see if this will make any difference. Talking about the charge itself, it appears from my reading the dash ones, instead of being an annual fee, it may be biannual, meaning over a two-year period.
And I've seen that.
Okay. And does that make any difference to the district itself? Is it just anything, because it starts small, it can continue to go?
I guess that was the feeling of the board, that I report to a board of directors of 9 directors, and they felt like that once, without a better term, the tax man cometh, once he gets his foot in the door, he just keeps coming.
All right. And if I can follow up one other question. Knowing the situation we find ourselves in as a state, knowing that this would be, from my understanding, and I'm limited, let's say, experience in this area, would be the first time that there would be this type of a tax. If there was, let's say, if there was a sunset on this fee, that means that after 2 years from now or 4 years from now, it would go away unless the legislature reauthorized it. Could that make a difference for the district?
I think the district's feelings was that sunsets seemed to come and go, but they never seemed to actually go.
Mm-hmm.
They never seemed to die.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
All right. I think it does. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll call the next panel up, and I'm going to hand the gavel just for a minute to Senator Prasansky. He's got the sheet.
Next panel is going to be Katie Fast, Jeff Stone, and it looks like Tom Wolf.
Good evening again, or afternoon. It's not that late yet.
Yeah, still sunny.
For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. The Oregon Farm Bureau, while we recognize that there are challenges this session with the Water Resources Department, we oppose 740 and do not see this as the mechanism to fund the Water Resources Department this session. Want to give an understanding of the fees that my members are already paying for water delivery. You have to recognize that irrigation districts and individual farmers have developed water supplies at an incredible expense, and they are currently still paying debt service on many of those projects and reservoirs within the state. Additionally, there are delivery fees associated to folks as individual irrigators or within irrigation districts for the pumping costs and electricity and maintenance on water supply projects to deliver that water to the farms. When you look at agricultural tax rates, there is a value added to your property when you do have irrigation or rights associated to it. And that is a, depending on the area, that is a increased cost in your tax rate that you are paying for the irrigation right that's attached to your land. So there are costs currently incurred by individual irrigators. When you look at the Water Resources Department, we do protest paying an annual fee by individuals who are not interacting with the agency. Currently, the agency charges fees for services, and that, we believe, is the correct mechanism to fund the agency under, and would like to discuss the fees in that framework as this session moves on. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Prevent-Zansky, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. We support Senate Bill 740. Just thinking in light of another agency, ODFW, they charge license fees for the use, the right to hunt and fish in Oregon, and I think this could be compared to that. Water is a very precious thing. You know, as coming from a family, six-generation Oregonian family whose many members are still farmers in Washington County, water is needed. It's what helps farmers grow their crops. It is the lifeblood of basically our society. And I don't think it's unreasonable to charge people an annual fee or biannual fee for the use of using this precious commodity. So whereas people are going to object to that, I think that it is a reasonable idea. We just don't have general fund money for agencies. When budgets are cut, the first general fund money that's always cut is the general fund, is the natural resource agencies. They're always one hits hardest, and so we need to look for a way to come up with a source of money for water resources, and this is a good idea. It needs to be implemented, because without this, an extra source of money, water resources just can't do the job that they're entrusted to by the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff?
Senator Prezonsky, members of the committee, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. I won't bear to repeat what you've already heard, but let me give some practical concerns about Senate Bill 740. Water Resources Department's primary interactions with the public is through water right requests and conflict management. And by contrast, Water Resources is not a taxing entity and is not a repository of records that would be needed to implement this bill. OAN submits that Water Resources Department would have a difficult time identifying the persons who own the property, the current holder of a water right, the underlying property owner, or the user of water that would be necessary in order to administer this fee. The fact is, the ownership information on file may be generations out of date. It's worth considering investing in Water Resources capacity to bring itself into current, to bring those records current, and to be able to contact the appropriate person. You've heard from Brenda Bateman already, and I imagine her donning a dusty fedora like Indiana Jones and going down the musty files of the in the bowels of Water Resources. But there are better uses for her time. But I wanted to see, in terms of practical effects, what does the certificate show? So I looked at water certificate 10,000. There are 85,000 water rights, so let's go through that. My electronic spot check revealed that the water right holder, Luke Walker, is from Klamath Falls, Oregon, and he settled his claim in the Sprague River. Sarah Prezonsky's already read my testimony, and was issued a certificate.
Luke Walker, you know.
Yeah. No, I get it.
Indiana Jones. Now we're in the search.
Yes, we are. That was not by accident, and took quite an effort.
Okay, like Jeff, you have a minute left.
Yes. The point is that it was finalized in 1930. And the water right goes back to 1881, so I find it hard to believe that we could actually find Mr. Walker, let alone give him a $100 bill. The We think that this, the, I mean, despite the levity, we do think it's a serious matter to examine fee-for-service like Ms. Fast had already indicated. And we would actually look at have you look at the totality of the fee increases that you're going to be doing as a legislature, because it's important. It's never been harder for my members to pay a fee as it is right now. So when you look at the cumulative effect of all the tax measures and fee measures that you will consider as a body, I'd like you to keep this one in mind.
Thank you. Tom?
Already done.
Oh, you've already done?
Yeah, we're
okay.
Quick.
Well, quickly, then, I will ask all of you, maybe I'll ask the two on the end, because I imagine you probably supported this since you checked that off here. And I certainly understand, and I think this committee does too, that fees are challenging, probably especially during time like this. However, you know that we're facing huge challenges with this budget because the Water Resources Department, 70% general fund, 30% funded through fees, and that really hasn't changed in many, many, many years. And it is the most heavily dependent general fund natural resource budget that we have. So I know you have both offered up solutions, and what I'm going to say is since this is one that's been offered up and since I know that you have concerns about it, I'm hoping that you are going to be willing to work with not just me but the chairs of the co-chairs of Ways and Means as we look for other options, because obviously we need to figure out how to fund this agency long-term, and I did see that in your testimony. Appreciate that.
Madam Chair.
Yep.
And also, Katie also said something about user fees, so that's one of the things I was going to follow up on. And we don't need it now, but it does seem like maybe we need to scope what does that mean? I mean, in the sense of what would be, how exponential of a cost increase would that be for those type of fees to be imposed on those individuals as compared to maybe a little bit across the board or some hybrid of that?
Thank you.
And Chair Dingfelder, I'd just like to respond. For the Oregon Farm Bureau, I mean, we've been in meetings with you and the co-chairs already in regards to the agency's budget, do have concerns. I'm bringing my association's water committee in to focus on that budget and come out with some solid recommendations. I think there are some potential funding sources out there for the agency and are definitely willing and want to be part of the solution as we look through that budget in the Ways and Means Committee.
Great. Thank you.
And likewise, Madam Chair, we feel a responsibility to not just say no, but to come with a package that we think represents keeping the core functions of the agency intact.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I apologize I had to run out, Mr. Testimony, but I certainly appreciate your willingness to work with us on as we attempt to move forward. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Next up, Dan Eisenbeis, Jim Welsh, and Mark Landauer. Actually, yeah, that's it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And if Dave Moskowitz is on deck, and so then just let him know. Okay, come on up, gentlemen. The clock is ticking. We will go till 5:15 today, so we have one other bill. I'm going to start losing members. Yeah, we're going to start losing members, and I will stay here till 5:15. I'm hoping that my co-chair, who is down on the first part, can stay till 5:15 with me. Okay. All right, so go ahead, Jim.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Jim Welsh with Oregon Cattlemen Association, and we do oppose this piece of legislation. I did go over the Dash 1, and there were some concerns as I talked to one of the cattlemen member from down in the Steens Mountain who had multiple water rights, and so the $100 per water right was quite an imposition, and they were very concerned about that. But we also are very concerned about the budget and for the Water Resources Department. And we certainly have the same question going to our members is what can we do during these times? And I propose in this, our members propose in our testimony that it should be, because it is for public interest and the Water Resources Department administering the waters of the state, it is important that we do get significant and appropriate funding from the general fund budget. And so we that are very challenged there this session. So we do believe that we should come up with some sort of an answer to your question on that. And our water committee is working on that, and so we'll participate and see if we can't be helpful some way in this. But we didn't think this was the way to go. During times that we're facing in our industry, this would be very difficult, especially for those who have multiple water rights. So.
Thank you. Mark or Dan, whoever.
Go ahead.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record again, Daniel Eisenbeis with the League of Oregon Cities. I just want to reiterate some of the comments that you've heard from one comment from other stakeholders, and that the League is quite interested in the Water Resources Department budget. We're taking it very seriously, and we feel a responsibility to help bring forth a proposal to maintain the ability of the department to carry out core services. With that said, I must speak in opposition to Senate Bill 740 as introduced and with the Dash 1 amendments. As has been mentioned earlier, the department is currently funded by about two-thirds general fund, one-third other fund. It should be noted that municipalities already pay a host of fees, and municipal ratepayers also pay for infrastructure at the local end in terms of delivering water for drinking water and industrial uses. This bill places a fee on water rights that have previously been legally granted. As introduced, it also excludes holders of in-stream water rights, certain state agencies, from paying such a fee. Municipal fees should be allocated to the specific activities that affect municipal water users. As currently drafted, this bill essentially puts this fee money into a very broad pot of money. For our members, we need to have some sort of assurance that the services that most directly relate to our ability to provide water to city residents are actually funded through fees that are levied. Couldn't pay a fee such as this and then see those services at the department be cut. The monies from fees also need to be accounted for at the department. This bill, as written, does not provide for that. In the bill as introduced, the water right cancellation clause in Section 1 sub 3 is really a threat to public safety, welfare, and health. It could mean that water rights that have been on the books for 100 years because a city somehow neglected to pay a $100 fee would be revoked, and then that city would be unable to provide water for fire protection, for instance. Section 2 sub 3 of the bill is introduced, specifies the uses of the fee money that largely relates to in-stream flows and protecting and enhancing those flows rather than some of the services that water users are dependent on. And I'll jump to the end. There's concerns about the implementation or the ability to implement this, and that it would take a lot of work up front. It won't solve the looming shortfall, and it seems that legislative council shares Senator Przanski's confusion about whether this is a fee or a tax.
Okay, Dan. Time's up. Okay. Thank you. Mark, I'm going to be rough because we've got only short time left.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Special Districts, and representing the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. Daniel was reading from my notes, so I'll just leave it at that. We are in opposition to the bill as drafted and the Dash 1 amendment for many of the same reasons that Mr. Eisenbeis has mentioned here today.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for coming.
Wait. Questions.
Oh, sorry. Questions. Gosh. I'm thinking about it. I got a half an hour left. One more hearing. Yes.
So, Jim, based on what your group's going to be looking at from the association, what I'm hearing is that it thinks this should be still as a general fund. So if it's going to be general fund funded, that means either we have to cut from existing programs on education, public safety, human services, or we have to have new revenue.
Right.
So I'm hoping that the association will take that all in consideration and give us actually what those plans are, mm-hmm. as to what alternatives are. And I would hope that the other people, as we've heard from the first one, so we can have the mix, because, I mean, we're going to be looking at stuff on the policy side, but, you know, down the way, we're in conference room F,
where they're going to really need to have a lot of stuff, especially this general fund projects.
Quick response, since you only used a minute of your time.
I'll just say I know that Daniel, if I may, Daniel, and my associations are committed to working with you members of the committee as well as the Ways and Means Committee to figure out how we can solve this fiscal problem that faces this particular department.
Thank you. And thank you for that comment, Senator Przanski. I feel like I'm a broken record because I've been saying that for so long, but I appreciate your comments on that, and we will be certainly looking to everybody who's come up here and testified in opposition to this for their ideas, so we appreciate your willingness to work with us. And last but not least, David Moskowitz. I should just let people just continue to sit up here because they'll be called up in a minute.
Chair Dingfeld, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz. I'm here today representing Native Fish Society. And a lot of this conversation started early in the session where we saw the revenue picture. And it was Mark Landauer himself. He said, what I'm concerned about is stability for this agency. And that's what this proposal is all about. The Water Resources Department, because of the 70% general fund funding, is not going to be able to provide for services to water right holders, to the public. It's not going to be able to do its job unless we figure out a way to fund it. This proposal is a long-term solution. You've heard a lot today about how difficult this will be to implement. The bill as written provides the commission the right to do a rulemaking to figure out how it's going to implement it, how it's going to enforce it, and that will take time. I think Jeff Stone's analogy of the expiration of the dusty confines of the department's records is probably very apt, but this is a long-term strategy. We've heard a lot today about willingness to work on the short term, which may include fees, but user fees alone will shortchange the public interest. Water Resources' obligation as a department is to protect the public interest as well as to provide services for specific users. User fees alone will not protect the public interest, and that's why we have to look at this as a long-term solution. It's very important that we move ahead with a fee that addresses all the water right holders. We may not find, there's 85,000 paper water rights. There may be many, many more less, fewer than that when it's all said and done. But this will put the department on a track for some long-term stability, which I believe that everybody who's been at this table today is interested in, and that's the encouraging thing. We've heard arguments that the cumulative effects of fees on some of these users makes them wary. But I guess I will challenge all the users who pay the multiple fees that they can't use that cumulative effect argument at every hearing in every committee in this building. At some point, the shoe has to drop, and we have to commit to some of these fees. And it was mentioned that in-stream water rights are exempted from this. Well, the state holds in-stream water rights in trust for the public. I'm not sure how you charge them the fee, but if that's what it takes to get people on board, then perhaps we'll look at that. But right now the issue is you've got all the out-of-stream rights which require services from the department, and we need to find a way to give that department the stability to make these key management decisions down the road. As for where these fees would go in Section 2 of the -1 amendments, we can work to narrow those. We're happy to work with anyone on that to find out where do we want these fees to go. I think that this is described as perhaps a revenue measure, but if we're careful about the scope of this, we can keep this as a fee and move this department forward.
Thank you, David.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay, with that, is there anyone else that would like to testify? I'm sorry, are there any questions for David?
No.
I'm going to start losing my members now, but... anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 740? Okay, before I close the public hearing on this, I will say that the chair is looking at a work group. Again, I think it's going to be a lot of the same people. You guys are going to be spending the next week together locked in a room. But with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 740. Again, Beth will be coordinating that, and you will be hearing from her. And last, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 788. Beth, if you can... give us an overview, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 788 makes legislative findings regarding peak and ecological flows. requires that the Water Resources Department, on the basis of studies provided by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, ensure that water storage project permits contain conditions to ensure the protection of peak and ecological flows and to ensure the protection of other flows necessary for the conservation, maintenance, and enhancement of native fish populations, aquatic insects, and organisms.
Okay. And in the interest of time, what I'll probably do is make sure that people that are not typically in the building can come up first after we hear from the first panel, and then we will try to fit everybody in, and certainly if we run out of time, we'll continue the public hearing at another time. I would like to ask up Leslie Bach, John DeVoe, and then we'll have the agency come up after that, actually. And then we'll hear from people that drove. We have a couple of folks from over 100 miles away. I want to make sure that we get up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Bach. I'm with the Nature Conservancy. And Nature Conservancy, we strongly believe that we must and that we can balance human needs for water with the needs of our streams and rivers, fish and wildlife, the needs that they have for water. And we believe very strongly that's something that must be done in the future and that we have the ability to do that. I think we know that high flows, winter flows, spring runoff flows are very critical, critically important to streams and rivers as they build and maintain in-stream habitat and they provide for key biological processes. And there's just a tremendous amount of scientific study, literature, information out there about the importance of these flows for maintaining streams and rivers, for protecting fish and wildlife. We also know that there's going to be a lot of demand on those higher flows in the future. For most of the year, surface water is fully allocated. There's going to be a lot of in the future, a lot of requests for water storage projects and water rights to fill those projects. And we really expect this demand to increase significantly in the future. So if that's going to happen, we believe that we need to consider and find a way to balance those needs with the needs for fish and wildlife. And we really believe that the state has the authority to conserve and maintain those flows and must do it. And, you know, I think ideally we'd like to see that done in some systematic, comprehensive way where across the state we would understand what the needs are, the high flow needs are throughout the rivers and streams in Oregon. But we also recognize that that's going to take, a lot of time, money, infrastructure, you know, folks to be able to do that. And we're not there right now. And we're certainly not going to be there in these budget times. So we think in the interim, the way to do that is to make sure that new storage rights, new winter water rights account for and protect the flow needs of fish and wildlife. And at this point, the way to do that is sort of, permit application by permit application, although, you know, ultimately we don't necessarily think that's the ideal way to do this. I think it's really important for us. We feel like the paradigm's different today than in the past, and that we can't, you know, do the same. We can't allocate the water the same way we did historically, and not account for the biological and ecological needs. And that it's very important to bring that science into this arena, and to make use of the tremendous amount of information, the methodologies, the approaches that are available there to evaluate or to determine the needs, the high water and spring runoff flows for fish and wildlife, incorporate those into our water right applications in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. This bill is needed because we have already allocated most of the water, the surface water of the state, in almost every basin between spring and fall. And so now the push is to store winter water either underground or in new storage projects above ground, and then use that water for various purposes during the rest of the year. I think the assumption has been that these higher flow events in the winter are excess to the system and that we can capture them and store them without any cost to our rivers. And the science is telling us that that's not the case. And this is not a new development. In fact, in 1997, the Oregon Plan directed the state to determine and protect the peak flows necessary for Oregon's streams and rivers. and the steelhead supplement to the Oregon plan committed to conditioning storage projects to ensure the protection of peak flows. Some of that work has been done, but we are not at a position now where we have a legal directive for the state to do that in conjunction with these new storage projects. And that's what makes this bill necessary now. We believe this can be done without a great deal of fiscal impact, and it's something that we need to do as we begin to move into the allocation of winter water across the state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Actually, we're going to hear from folks from out of town and the non-in-the-building folks, and then I'm actually going to ask the Department of Fish and Wildlife and Water Resources Department come up because I have some questions for them that I'd like to make sure get on the record. Patrick Griffiths and David Newton are from 100 miles away. Is there anybody else here from 100 miles away that maybe didn't sign that they were? Okay. And then Peggy Lynch, why don't you come up? Okay. Patrick, why don't you start?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Patrick Griffiths, I'm the Water Resources Coordinator from the City of Bend. Again, thank you for the opportunity. Currently, the City of Bend is opposed to Senate Bill 788 the way it's written. I want to get that on the record right off the bat. But I also want to say we fully understand the importance of these critical flows. We've been working together collaboratively with the Deschutes Water Alliance for many, many years now. And frankly, we're working to put these flows to the most beneficial use for fish, wildlife, farms, and folks, and we're having great success with that. We're really concerned that we think there's existing statutory rules in place and other rules with ODF&W for protecting these flows. We are familiar with the process that you're going to hear some testimony later about that. We think the Division 33 public interest review process is working and shouldn't be thrown out and replaced with possibly really inflexible rules in their place. And so just to finish, I think the main concern the City of Bend has is this is going to limit flexibility for future water development, especially in the development of ASR projects and recharge projects that really can have a balanced benefit to our basin. And with that, I'll give my time to the other panelists. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. David, welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Dave Newton. I'm the president of Newton Consultants in Redmond, Oregon. I'm an Oregon licensed civil engineer, engineering geologist, water right examiner. My firm provides consulting service to private and public entities to help them strategically plan for and secure water supply for the future need. I've also been heavily involved with Mr. Griffiths and the Deschutes Water Alliance in the Deschutes Basin with broad-based water resources planning. I'm also involved in quite a number of storage projects. Three basic points. One, I think, do we really need the bill? Number two, if the bill's implemented, there's some significant technical considerations that need to be considered in implementing the bill. And number three, I had some suggestions. Oregon Fish and Wildlife already reviews applications for water rights and limited licenses, including those for storage projects. So we do have a system in place that looks at storage projects. Maybe it's weak, but maybe we can fix it, and I'm optimistic we can. Again, that's through Oregon Administrative Rules 690, Division 33. And they also have written guidance available for protecting peak flows, and it's this manual they've actually developed and used to evaluate peak flow conditions for storage projects. We've gone through one project with ODF&W using this guidance, and we're in the process of another storage project. We use this ourselves, anticipating this is going to be a criteria. So I think we've got some good systems in place to use. There is no surface water available at critical times for future needs. The waters are fully appropriated, and groundwater is limited due to connectivity with surface waters and the potential effect of groundwater withdrawals on senior water rights. Storage of excess winter flow, I say excess, respectfully for Mr. DeBoe's comments, but storage of winter flow is clearly needed and recognized as a key solution for our future supply needs. Aquifer storage is a key tool being explored by the Governor's Climate Change Commission, and conservation certainly is important, but it's not the panacea for our future needs. On the technical side, peak flows must be based on sound and defensible science. This is essential, considering the role of storage in future water supply, and a couple points. Historic flow data is necessary to properly determine peak flow needs and water availability for storage. Hundreds of subwatersheds are ungauged and no historical flow data is available. There are other methods to estimate peak flow needs in the absence of that historical data, but they involve assumptions which can lead to conservatism in findings. This in turn results in denial of storage projects that could otherwise be factually warranted. Suggestions: one, impanel a task force to assess the existing available administrative resources and scientific tools for evaluating processing storage permits. Confirm the practical need for this bill. Task force would also evaluate scientific validity of empirical methods for estimation of peak flow in the absence of historical data. Recommendations and necessary follow-up actions, if necessary, then could be made for future legislation.
We have your written testimony and certainly appreciate that and appreciate your suggestions. Peggy?
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. You will see before you a letter that not written by me today, but the reason I bring it to you and the reason you have heard us in two previous bills is that League of Women Voters feels very strongly that the issue of water in this state bubbles to the top. And in spite of our fiscal problems, we really do need to address the issues surrounding water. And certainly, peak and ecological flow is a part of that. As you will note in our letter, we have supported legislation dealing with this issue in the past. We note that it is necessary to support not only aquatic life, but to minimize pollution and to provide for recreation. So Oregon's regulation of water is now facing new challenges brought on as a result of expanding water withdrawal needs, you have just heard that, drought situations, and the threat of significant climate change. So this legislature's involvement in this issue is both realistic and wise. We ask that you support Senate Bill 788, declaring legislative findings and new procedures, ensuring that the necessary peak and ecological flows are considered and protected in the process of permitting water storage projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And I may be following up with you, Dave, with some questions. I'm going to call up one more panel, and then I'm going to have the agencies come up because I have some questions for them with some out-of-towners who I know won't be able to come back. David Filippi.
That's you, Madam Chair.
Right, and it's the majority leader, so I better put that away. I hope he's not listening, and I'm not answering his phone call. David, why don't you go first?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Filippi. I'm a partner with the law firm of Stoll Reeves LLP in Portland, Oregon. My practice centers on water rights and project permitting. I have represented and continue to represent irrigation districts and water users all over the state and have done so now for nearly 13 years. While my testimony today is in furtherance of many of my clients' interests, I'm really here on my own behalf and my own nickel, and I do appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm opposed to this bill for three primary reasons. First, Senate Bill 788 runs counter to the careful balancing of interests that are embodied in Oregon's current water rights statutes and department policy. Currently, the issuance of a new water right involves careful balancing of various competing interests and needs through a public process, and in past legislatures have noted the competing needs for water and have declared that such balancing is the appropriate approach. And throughout ORS Chapter 536, I think it's evident that is the process. The concern with this bill is that it elevates a particular interest, and that is the asserted benefit of peak and ecological flows, and removes that interest from what would otherwise be the normal balancing process. At least with the current process for protecting in-stream flows, ODFW has to go through a permitting process, and it's the same process that any other water user must go through, whereby ODFW has to apply for and justify a particular in-stream water right application as part of a public process. The burden is on ODFW to prove that that the amount that's requested is beneficial and needed. The fundamental flaw with this bill is that it reverses the presumption and it presumptively protects peak and ecological flows from other uses that would have otherwise been approved through the normal balancing and permitting process. And just as a textbook example, one project that some of my clients very much support involves a potential development of a storage reservoir that would store water in the winter and then release that water in the summer with the summer releases dedicated to supporting listed fish species. And under this bill, we never even get to that the discussion of that sort of a project because the winter flows are reserved and no longer made available for the storage project. On the other hand, the current permitting process promotes balancing, and I do believe that this bill turns the process on its head by declaring up front that water allocations for human use shall be balanced separately from protecting peak and ecological flows. And I would just say that if the water users had proposed a bill that had set aside all peak and ecological flows for storage for human use, I think that the proponents of this bill would be opposing that sort of a bill just as strongly. The two other points that I would make, first is just that I do believe that this bill lacks proper scientific foundation. The bill is a very broad brush to protect flows without really any attempt to describe the functional contribution of peak flows in a given stream reach or otherwise provide for optimal prescriptions of how those flows should be protected. And I would finally echo the comment that was made earlier that ODF&W already has the authority to pursue in-stream water rights, and they already have the authority to comment on other applications to provide this sort of flow protection.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. We do have your full written testimony, so I apologize about the rush and appreciate you being here today. Nikki. You get two for one today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to comment on this bill. I've already introduced the Joint Water Commission that I'm representing today
and
as
just,
well.
If you can state your name again.
Nikki Iverson, Water Resources Manager, representing the Joint Water Commission. I'd like to just express some of our concerns with the bill relative to the impacts to our ASR programs. Three of our member agencies have extensive ASR programs that are an integral part of our water supply plan, and we are really worried about the impacts of this bill to ASR in general. We did some calculations before the hearing today, and we have calculated that our diversions for ASR represent less than 1% of a peak flow event on an annual basis. We believe that this is an extensive study and additional cost to our agencies to implement that for such a small amount of diversions for ASR. We do also believe that wintertime flows are components of our water supply strategy to meet Washington County's growing needs. The bill is also very vague, and we're really concerned about some of the undefined terms in the bill and the impacts that those would have at this point. So some of those phrases we would really appreciate to be defined or clarified so that we had a better understanding of the impact to our agencies. Also, I'd like to also reiterate that ODF&W currently has guidance that they do apply on all new permits, and that we would just like the committee to give us that a chance to work. They've only had, I think, one opportunity to apply that guidance at this point, but we would like to see that process implemented and see if it works over time.
Thank you. Thank you. Orna.
Orna Stickle, Portland Water Bureau. Our concerns are also associated with the ASR or underground storage aspect of this bill primarily, and our specific issue, which is detailed in our letter, is that it would allow going back on already granted rights, mm-hmm. potentially statutory rights, as is our Bull Run rights, and two certificates that have already been granted for municipal use. And it's our view that that is that issue was dealt with during several legislatures between 1995 and 2003, and it's eminently clear in the existing statute, and we list it and say what it is here, that if the intention was that if the source water for the ASR project already had a municipal permit and that the purpose of the ASR project was for municipal purposes, you did not need to go back and reevaluate that and redo a public interest determination. So we have some specific language suggested to alleviate that problem. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for these folks? Okay. Thank you very much. And I'm going to have Tom Wolf come up because you are not always in the building, I know, unless you can definitely come back. I'm actually going to we're going to have Tom Wolf, and I'm going to ask the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Water Resources Department to come up because I have some questions. And then if we have time, we'll hear the remaining four folks that I know can come back next time if need be. Tom?
Chair Dingfelder, committee member.
My name is Tom Wolf. I'm
two. There's two.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. We support this bill. Peak ecological flows. Nothing has demonstrated the value of those more than what happened when they removed Marmot Dam a little over a year. Within just a short period of time, the peak flows flushed out the system, and in much faster than anybody thought. The system now is providing access to spawning habitat for different species of listed fish. So it is very important to protect peak ecological flows. They're required, of course, for flushing out debris, for clearing out and stirring gravel that fish can use for spawning, for moving large woody debris into the stream, and also for moving young smolts during the spring down the system quickly so they can get out in the proper time to complete their smoltification as they move out to sea. It's very important to protect these, and we think that this bill does that. It does that in very clear language, so we support this bill and all its language. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions, committee member? Thank you. And I like the term smoltification. We'll use that with our colleagues and see if we can stump them. I would like to have the departments come up, the Fish and Wildlife and Water Resources Department. I have a few questions for you, and then I think we will have time for the last four folks who have signed up. So this is a question for whoever at Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I've taken some notes as I was reading through this bill, and we've heard about the importance of peak flows from several folks, but if you, from a Fish and Wildlife perspective, want to give your official opinion on that, I think that would be good to get that on the record, if you can explain the importance of peak flows and why they're needed.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, and I did provide written testimony as well, which...
And state your name for the record,
sorry.
Please.
Trying to be quick here at this late hour. Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I have with me here Rick Kepler, our Water Program Manager, that can certainly address any more specific technical questions. But in general, peak flows are those flows that are associated with bed load movement and stream morphology, important processes in terms of habitat maintenance, and as well as cleaning the gravels and other functions like those. Ecological flows are flows where there's not bed load movement, but in fact there are important flow levels they're referred to as triggering events. So they may trigger out-migration of juveniles, they may trigger in-migration by adults or other important life history characteristics of fish or aquatic species.
Okay.
Rick, anything you would add to that? Okay, thanks.
So, and we've heard a lot already about administrative rules and the Division 33 rules that you can currently recommend conditions, and I've written down, I think we had many, many people come up and say this, for new permits to protect flows, you know, necessary for these for sensitive or threatened or endangered species. So, I guess, and since we have the Water Resources Department right here, does the Water Resources Department have to follow your recommendations? Maybe we'll have both of you answer that,
I'll
start with you, Kurt.
I think in our written testimony does address this a little bit as well. In the last paragraph on the first page, existing statute and rule does provide us with the implicit or implied authority to give advice and recommendations to the Water Resources Department on the need to protect peak flows. This legislation would make it more explicit as opposed to implicit. With regard to the question about are they required to follow our recommendations, I guess I would defer to the more technical experts on that question.
Why don't you go ahead and state your name for the record, and then Brenda, need a microphone now.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, my name is Rick Kepler. I'm the Water Program Manager for Oregon Fish and Wildlife. So basically, our recommendations are recommendations. The Water Resources considers them along with a lot of other considerations. Most of the time, since we are making determinations based on fish, they will include those conditions in a permit. So, but there is a whole process.
Will or can?
They will. They can as well.
Yeah.
You know. So, but they are recommendations. They aren't a requirement that they take our our recommendations and put them in a permit. Most of the time they do, and we usually, whenever we're talking about a permit, we end up negotiating with the permit holder, the applicant, as to what those will be finally. So.
Thank you. And Brenda, would you like to comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, for the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with Water Resources Department. And just wanted to take a tiny step back and say a few years ago, ODFNW did develop a written process for both agencies to use with regard to peak flow protection. So whenever our department receives an application for storage, we notify Fish and Wildlife, and we also send them all the materials that we've received so that they can consider them in putting together their permit conditions. And when then in response, they provide recommendations to us, we do include them in the proposed final order, although oftentimes there's some back and forth clarifying phone calls and questions, but we do take their recommendations and build those in.
So you're using this guidance in evaluating, say, new storage projects or whatever, because, you know, I worked on the Oregon plan, I know back in 1997, there was discussion about including peak flow information, and this was over 10 years ago, and so the question I have is what progress have we made? I think I was back there when that first that policy was first implemented, but it's, you know, it's been now 12 years. So I don't know if there's something maybe you can work on together that and bring back to the committee and say, here's the progress we've made. Rick?
Rick Kepler. Chair Dingfelder, we certainly can. I will note that we have made some progress because we basically, I had a document, a scientific document put together on how to, for ODFNW to figure out how to analyze these peak flow requests. We haven't had we only had a few of them so far. However, we're having a whole lot of people interested in peak flows. And that actually that document is on our website, so anybody can look at it.
Okay. And then I guess a follow-up question to the department is then what, besides the individual, you know, when you review permit applications or water storage projects, are you doing anything on a basin wide level to protect those peak flows?
Madam Chair, I believe that the basin look is part of our larger water availability calculation that we go through. But as I mentioned, whenever we get applications for storage, we've sent those over to make sure that they're part of the consideration and part of the dialogue between both agencies.
Okay, so as far as though, I guess I'm looking at, like, you know, a longer-term plan for protecting those peak flows, since they're an important element. What I'm hearing is applications come in, I mean, you're responding to it. I guess I'm looking for a more proactive approach.
Madam Chair, to mention in previous budget cycles, the department has made a request for hydrologists that would be dedicated to specifically these types of issues and have not received those positions. So it's this kind of discussion and dialogue that we are interested in pursuing. We would definitely need the hydrology resources in order to accomplish the goals of this bill or something similar.
And Rick, did you want to comment on that?
Chair Dingfelder, one of the things I want to mention is that we have worked over the last couple of years to work with the governor on his initiative for what's called H2O, and that was a major, and you'll see in our testimony, that was a major impetus there, is to look at these kind of flows in a holistic, basin-wide manner. Unfortunately, the budgets and finances have reduced that amount. So.
Well, and that's why we passed out a bill 193, which I think you were out for that one. But that's why I felt ODFNW had to be at the table, because we've already said, and we already have, you know, in 1997 the Oregon Plan directed ODFNW and the department to look at peak flows, and that was one of the reasons I felt that the department should be there as an equal player with the Water Resources Department and DEQ for that reason. But yes, resources are going to be a challenge, and hydrologists, you know, we're looking at cutting positions for that. But doesn't mean that the need for this important, you know, function goes away. So appreciate that. Do you have any questions for the departments while they're up here? And then we have four more people. If we can get you down to 2 minutes each, we can get you all in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for both departments. Ultimately, under Oregon law, which department or agency, if it's not yours, has the responsibility or the final authority in saying what is a peak flow and what is the flow of the streams? Who has the measurement authority?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, there's actually a double-layer answer there, I believe. The Water Resources Department has the responsibility for the hydrology, that is saying what water is there. And on the flip side, ODFW would have the biologists who would say, this is what fish need or wildlife need. So you'd match those together to make your determination about what water is there, what the in-stream needs are, and therefore what's available after that.
Follow-up question, Andrew. And at what point does or why would either Water Resources Department or ODFW concede its authority to the Forestry Department?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, Water Resources Department is responsible, ultimately responsible for allocation of water, formal allocation of water within the state. I'll leave it there.
Bert?
Yeah.
Obviously, I have a specific.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, I honestly don't know the answer to that question, and so I'd be happy to follow up with you on a conversation.
Follow up.
Yeah,
okay.
That would be great. And just the Water Resources Department is the one who is ultimately responsible for issuing the permit. There's consultation with the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
I'm all on that. It's just not the way it works.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And if folks are willing to get down to 2 minutes, we can get the rest of you up here. You're all sitting in the back. Jeff Stone, Mark Landauer, and it's like the usual panel. Dan Eisenbeis, I don't know if he's still here, and Dave Moskowitz come up to finish off the party. Okay, gentlemen. Mark, why don't you go first?
Okay.
We're down to 2 minutes, and I really want to thank Senator Boquist.
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, Mark Landauer representing the Special Districts and the Association of Water Utilities. We oppose this bill. I'll try to keep this to 30 seconds. ODF&W is already providing comments on peak flow analysis. The bill presumptively allocates peak flow to in-stream rights. The language is vague. The studies are very expensive. And one point that hasn't been made that I think is important to note is that when WRD makes a proposed final order and does not necessarily accept in whole or in part ODF&W's recommendations, the order can be challenged by any individual who is concerned about peak flows, which spins you into another entire different cycle. So I just think that that's one point that hasn't been mentioned here that's important to be made.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Dan.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis, League of Oregon Cities. As has been said, there is already a process in place for reviewing peak flows and permits and negotiating a solution to balance all the interested needs. The language of this bill is incredibly broad, and it would effectively block issuance of water storage project permits. These water storage projects are going to be particularly important as climate change reduces the level of snowpack in Oregon. The bill appears to not just be about winter water. It also refers to, quote, other flows, which are not defined, whereas the peak and ecological flows are defined. It extends the authority and requirement for review of other flows to all organisms, not only fish or aquatic insects. And the cost of this is going to be absolutely tremendous. The figures that multiple consultants have delivered in terms of estimates is that a peak flow analysis in a larger basin would run $50,000 to $75,000. The cost-benefit analysis about whether the storage project would be worth the money compared to other options would run in the vicinity of $250,000. And the operational model used to actually forecast the weather and implement the system would run about $300,000. In short, this bill appears to be a fairly radical departure from the status quo and one that could really cripple our system.
Thank you, Dan. And I would be remiss as a water trained as a water resources planner that I think your claim about climate change makes it even more important that we analyze these flows and protect them because they are going to be at risk. But that was a issue. I meant to ask ODF&W, but they got away before I could ask them that way. Thank you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Madam Chair, for the record, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'll be exceptionally brief.
And we have your written testimony.
Yes, and you have my written testimony that goes into quite a bit of detail about our concerns about this bill. We oppose it mainly because we believe that it requires this issue requires additional scientific study, particularly for something that has a hard time being defined or evaluated. And we just don't like how the bill is conceived and written as it is. And you've talked about interim groups throughout the three bills that you have suffered with me being up here. This is one that particularly, I think, requires an interim effort with all the stakeholders. It is certainly one that came up during your roundtables during the summer. It certainly came up with the governor's H2O group. And so I think that I would commend and I would like to ask my fellow members up here at this panel to join us and really get into this issue and come back with a recommendation in 2011. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And last but not least, David gets a little into the podium there.
Madam Chair, my name is members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here on
I was going to say August members of the committee.
Yes, and we really appreciate your willingness to pound through a very ambitious agenda today. Senate Bill 788 on peak flows is a very important bill that tries to perhaps prevent an unwise rush to grab winter flows that are believed to be wasted. If you talk to people, look at the Columbia flowing out to the ocean in the wintertime, they say, look at all that water that we're not putting to good use. Those flows have a function, a critical function, and I would disagree with my colleagues up here about the establishment of the science, whether this is a well-known field. He's going to pull the plug on me. This is much more well established than they are giving it credit for. And one of the things I think that we failed to look at is what has the peak flow analysis given us at this point? And we can look right to Umatilla, where there's a proposal to take winter water out of the Columbia and put it underground and use it for crops and to restore flows in the Umatilla. That water out of the Columbia is basically a no. There's not water available. But the peak flow analysis told us, yes, there actually is water available at certain times of the year. And that's what's going to allow this project to go forward. The same is true on a case on a tributary that is Deschutes, where the water availability analysis said, no, there's no water available. Peak flow analysis was conducted, and no turned to yes. Okay, that's what's possible under this bill. And We definitely accept the offer to work on this. We'd like to work on it now. If there's not a willingness to study to put peak flow analysis into this now, then we shouldn't be allowing this water to be used for storage until we've done that.
Thank you, David.
Happy to answer your questions.
Are there any questions for this panel?
Well, Madam Chair, I get rebuttal since you Dan, I just want you to know that the snow levels and the depths in my neck of the woods are larger this year despite climate change.
And as a skier, I certainly appreciate that.
They're going up, not down. So I don't know what the deal is, but I just want that on the record.
Thank you, Senator Boquist, and thank you for your patience in staying here over time tonight. Thank you all. I apologize about the rush, but we did get through some very important discussions, and you will be hearing from Beth, I'm sure, on any, if not all, of these bills. So with that, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 788. We won't have to hold this over since we did get through everybody. And with that, I will close the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee and see you next week.